roll, baby, on MMA Junkie Radio with Gorgeous George and Goz. This is what we do and why we do it, baby. We rollin'!
Covering MMA from all over the world, this is the premier stop for all your combat sports needs. MMA Junkie Radio from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino in the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. The lights are on and the mics are hot. It's time to get your MMA fix, junkies. Take it away, Big John.
Gorgeous George and Goz, are you ready? Junkie Nation, are you ready? Well, let's get it on.
What's going on, Junkie Nation? Gorgeous George and Goz reporting for duty here on a Monday. We are going to talk about this past weekend's events, primarily the UFC 256 pay-per-view card, which took place Saturday here in Las Vegas, and that included a title fight. Davison Figueiredo and Brandon Moreno fought to a draw. That's right. Now, the champ walks away with the belt, so all's well, I think, in his world. I don't even know what happens with win bonuses. I don't think either guy gets win bonuses, but I think both guys get bonused just because it was a tremendous fight. So we'll talk all about that, as well as the co-main event, Charles Oliveira taking out El Cocoy Tony Ferguson. That sounds so strange because for 10 years, Tony Ferguson took out everybody. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about Kevin Holland going 5-0 in 2020, including his win over Jacare Souza. Junior Dos Santos takes his fourth straight loss at the hands of Cyril Gane. Mackenzie Dern just keeps getting better. And, of course, Bellator on Thursday night, Juliana Velasquez, she defeated Elena Montlane McFarland. She's the new flyweight champion over there. So tons of other news to cover. Also, thank you to everybody that tuned in on Saturday for our UFC 256 watch-along. We had a great time, so we'll talk about that event, tell you about when we think the next watch-along will be, and we'll also welcome our colleague, Nolan King. He'll join us at 12:15 p.m. Eastern, 9:15 a.m. Pacific, so he can help us unpack these cards. He was actually at the Mohegan Sun in Connecticut. He saw Velasquez take out McFarland there, cage side. All right, folks, buckle up. It's MMA Junkie Radio on Monday, December 14th.
Habla español, amigo.
Hola amigos, Danny Segura dropping in. Just wanted to let you know about MMA Junkie's latest podcast. It's Hablemos MMA, a weekly Spanish language show dedicated to all things professional fighting. Each Monday, we recap the major events from the weekend, plus we analyze the week's biggest news. We also bring you exclusive interviews with the best fighters, coaches, and experts in the Hispanic and Latin American scene. You can find Hablemos MMA every Monday morning on your favorite podcasting platform. Suscríbete y nos hablamos pronto. Chao.
All right, folks, here we go. You know, because I was thinking, I want to save a little bit for a discussion with Nolan as well, you know, as we tackle all of these topics together. So let's homer a little bit and talk about Cub Swanson and his win. Cub Swanson defeated Daniel Pineda on the prelims. And, you know, we were open about this on our UFC 256 watch along. We sponsored this guy back when we were the podcast Tag Radio. We're very close to him. He lived in Tustin. We lived in Santa Ana. Covered him for about 15 years now. Huge, huge win for him.
Yeah, I think it was a good performance for him in the sense that if Cub would have went out there and just KO'd him, let's just say, in less than a minute or something, there would still be those questions like, is he back 100%? How did the knee hold up? All those types of things, the jitters. So him being able to do that over a period of time and face a little bit of adversity, because remember, Pineda was banging the hell out of that leg.
Yeah.
And it was giving Cub some problems. So he even got through a little bit of adversity and showed a lot of old Cub Swanson tricks. So great performance for him. I think he's got to be really, really happy for that. And then I think everybody kind of puts to bed. And, you know, even at one point, I think, didn't he even kind of go after the leg and the submission? So I think Cub answered a lot of questions that night with that victory.
Yeah, he sure did. Cub had been out for a year due to an injury that he sustained in the grappling world versus Jake Shields. Prior to that, he had beaten Cron Gracie. So this is two in a row in MMA for Cub Swanson. off the heels off a four-fight losing streak prior to that. But, yeah, he was attacking that leg. Pineda's a hard kicker. You could tell, man. He just got big old rugby legs, you know what I mean? And he was going after Cub. He was making him spin around and pirouette a little bit. But Cub never really got flustered. He got concerned, but not flustered. He switched his stance. He made adjustments. He tried to check or at least get his leg out of the way, you know, or maybe roll and lessen the impact from when a leg is planted. So I liked that. But what I also liked was these veterans that get past, I would say, the lighter weight classes, 30 to 35. You're a veteran who's starting to close down your career. Of course, there's some anomalies out there. And then the middleweight to heavyweight, it's 35 to 40 where we start getting concerned, you know. And so for Cub, who's now, I think, 37, he wasn't hesitant. He actually started throwing, and he took advantage of his fast hands. So when Pineda did kick him, Cub met him with a couple punches. When Pineda was thinking of kicking him, Cub met him with some punches. So then next thing you know, Pineda was thinking about Cub's strikes before Cub was thinking about the leg kicks that might come his way. And that's what I think helped him a lot. Now, some of that damage, it started to multiply, and you saw it in Pineda, you know, the way he was wearing it. I also think it affected his cardio. You know, I think the damage just started to wear him down that way as well. And then what Cub did, and I actually told him this last night because I accidentally texted him instead of you because he was on my mind. And next thing you know, I'm having a conversation. And luckily I didn't say, did you see that fool Cub? I didn't say anything like that. I just mentioned something about trying to maybe book him, you know, sometime this week. And then I realized I was talking to him. But what I told him was he was surgical. He was precise. He was efficient. He was looking for his openings. He was very patient. He didn't rush it. He knew that he had a little bit of a wounded soldier in front of him. And what he needed to do was make sure he didn't get caught by one of those heavy strikes that Pineda likes to throw. Not just the kicks, the knees, punches. But as long as he could do that while the other guy's gas tank was emptying out, then we were going to be in good shape.
That's funny. What exactly did you send him in that first message?
Let me see if I got it here. Where are we at? Cub. I sent him, hey, bud. No. Well, first of all, I said, are we doing guests tomorrow? As you know, last Thursday, we had a problem with patching in our guest, Jamal Hill. And it has to do with an update here on StreamYard, kind of technical talk. Maybe Ghost can chime in if he wants, but we're still not buttoned down yet. Has nothing to do with Sportscaster or Junkie Radio. It's just an update done on StreamYard. StreamYard's the broadcasting software that we used. And then hey dummy, did you hear this?
No way. That's what he said?
I'm just kidding. No, I immediately caught it and I said, sorry, Cub, meant for goes. And then at that point I just figured I'd tell him, hey, great fight. And we'd love to have you on the show this week. And so, you know, thank you. He wrote back and he was excited, relieved, all that. So we'll save that for when we have him on the show. But I guess it was quick. But anyway, yeah, what did you think of the way Cub put away Pineda?
I thought it was legit, man, because it was pretty surgical. And one of Cub's problems, I think, in the past is when he feels that finish coming on, he can get a little sloppy because he'll chase you a little bit with the hands down and all that. And in this one, I think he just – It really was one of his better performances. Like, he had a real nice jab. I mean, he was able to mix all of his strikes together, but he knew when the right opportunity was to strike. And then at the end, man, just the stamp, you know, the big shot that put him down and then the stamp at the end, and you see him scream and you can tell just how much all this meant to him, all the stress that he's probably going through. Amazing performance for him.
Yeah, and this wasn't so much the relief of cracking a four-fight losing streak, because remember, he did that last year against Cron Gracie. It was the relief, I think, of coming back from a major injury at this age and still on the heels of a 4-5 losing streak prior to his last loss. I mean, you know, remember, folks, when you're the toast of the town, when you're a contender, when you're next, which that opportunity didn't come to him. He was always edged out by somebody else. But still, you know, when you're a top five, top 10 guy, and then all of a sudden that falls out. And those guys read, man. They read and listen and, you know, everything that's out there that's said about them. And sometimes it just doesn't go over well, that raw, honest truth that writers, that, you know, the journalists have to say. Mm-hmm. And in our sport, we can say defeated, you know, one athlete defeated the other one. But the fans say one guy got his ass kicked. One guy doesn't belong. One guy this, one guy that. That adds up, man. So, you know, and then the doubt starts to creep in. And remember, the only way you can shake it off is to go back in there against another trained killer. That cannot be pleasant, man.
Oh, no. This has got to be one of those. I wonder if there's a little bit of a chip on Cubs' shoulders. Because, look, man, I mean, we're not dumb. When you look at the matchmaking here, to me, it seems like the UFC said this behind closed doors. They said, if Cub wins, he's back. But if he loses, we put over another guy, young guy, using Cub Swanson. And I think he's smart enough to realize that's probably what was said behind closed doors. And, he's probably never really been in that situation before because we've always looked at him as that young Cub Swanson in the WEC days and then making his way in the UFC. But Cub is an established veteran now, you know. He still has that young look, but he's an established veteran. And these types of matchups are going to start getting thrown his way.
Yeah, and on the same card, we had a younger Ciryl Gane versus Junior Dos Santos, former UFC heavyweight champ. We also had Kevin Holland, a younger Kevin Holland, against Ronaldo Jacare Souza, a former Strikeforce middleweight champ. Heck, let's just go a couple weeks before. RDA, I know he wound up fighting Paul Felder, but he was supposed to fight Islam Makhachev, a young gun coming up against the former lightweight champion. Now, I know the theme here seems Brazilian. A lot of these Brazilian stars are aging. Jose Aldo has Marlon Vera this week. But yeah, once you start getting paid well, you have to at least be a 500 fighter, or maybe go 2-1, 2-1, 2-1. So that's what a 666 fighter, I guess, if you use the percentage game. But you start incurring those losing streaks and they're paying you a lot of money, sometimes they'll go with the younger guy, you know, and that's happened here. Anderson Silva, Yoel Romero, you know, they're in their 40s now, and they have to justify whether they can make that payment because they can easily get somebody to be a brand new star if they give that brand new star a chance. So the UFC's fine tweak their definition of superstars, headliners over the years, you know what I mean? And now they have so many different revenues of income. You know, now they have a big ESPN deal. They have an apparel deal. They have the UFC Fight Pass. Imagine when they didn't have all that. And some of these other decisions really, really hinged on whether you could draw a crowd or not. And right now there are no crowds. Right now, though, they do have stable income from ESPN. So I think it's always, can we find the next couple superstars? We'll give our aging superstars an opportunity, but they have to perform. So again, back to what we were saying, Cub did perform. He is now on a 2-fight win streak. Everybody loves Cub, and I think he'll just continue getting these younger guys unless he gets on his own 4 or 5 win streak. Then maybe he'll match him up against a top 10 veteran guy, and then maybe he can get back to contender. He said it. He'd like to, you know, become a contender again, but we'll see.
You know that this old guard that we were just talking about, you know, your Yoel Romero's, your Junior Dos Santos, those guys, this is only going to get worse because right now you're seeing fighters that are fighting into their 40s. But it's because a lot of them probably got late starts. You know, mixed martial arts is something that didn't appear in their lives when they were kids. They weren't in their first grade class going, I'm going to be a mixed martial artist. That wasn't a thing. It wasn't a job. And now you have this new crop of kids that are training from the very beginning. When they get out of high school or even when they're in high school, they go to an MMA gym and they train mixed martial arts. They don't train jiu-jitsu. And then when they're done, they decide, I'm going to take up boxing. And then I'm going to take up – they do it all at once. And so what's happening is these guys are ready to fight at a younger age, which means they're putting a lot of mileage on their body at a younger age, which means they're not going to go into their 40s. I think you're going to start seeing, well, what we look at with fighters in their 40s now, I think is going to be like 35 in a couple years, where we go, oh man, he's 35. It might be time to go. One guy that I can think of is Rory McDonald, is a guy that kind of came on the scene really early, but his exit is going to be a lot more earlier now too. There's a few of these guys that are starting to get into that, and it's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. He had some wars along the way, you know. Mm-hmm. Luckily, he did win a major title once. It wasn't in the UFC, but I think anything after now is probably about setting him and his family up for the future and just banking big dollars, you know. He'll be in PFL, by the way, in 2021. They canceled this season, otherwise he would have been there, and I'm sure he would have been one of the favorites at welterweight. But let's give off the results for the rest of this card. And then I think Nolan King, one of our writers at MMA Junkie, will be joining us soon.
What do you think of this? So today he wrote me in Spanish, and I was cracking up. But I kind of like calling him Nolando Rey.
Sure. But I think Danny Segura might have a problem with that, our host there for the Spanish-speaking broadcast. But, yeah, I mean, I'm down for anything.
I want him to do that show as Nolando Rey. If Danny can ask him 5 questions that we already know ahead of time what they're going to be, and we can write the answers in Spanish and have Nolan say them in Spanish, I think that would be epic. Think about how many people.
It'd be worse than us having to put up with Waleed Ismail speaking English, right?
Yeah.
He super defeated Peter Barrett in the early prelim. There was 10 fights overall. Then they moved to the ESPN portion, which is the 4-fight prelims card prior to the pay-per-view. Tisha Torres got her first TKO stoppage win, defeating Sam Hughes, who subbed in late for Angela Hill. Gavin Tucker defeated Billy Quarantillo, a decision there, but it was unanimous, 30-27 across the board. Rafael Fiziev defeated Hanato Moicano, brutal KO punches there, round one. Got a feel for Moicano, man. He was almost a top five guy, maybe even a top five guy, and now he's not really relevant at featherweight nor lightweight. He's not taking these punches well, but we'll see. And then, of course, Cub Swanson, I mentioned, with Daniel Pineda. So I hear our guest and colleague Nolan King is ready to go. Is he ready to go?
Yeah, looks like.
We'll be joined by Nolan King, and now we'll unpack the UFC 256 pay-per-view.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports, featuring For the Win's Stephen Ruiz and Chris Corman.
I know people are like just assuming that this is an upgrade at the quarterback position, but I don't think we could say that for a fact. I'd say it's a downgrade.
He never really had game-to-game impact, just coming off the edge and destroying people that we thought when we saw his athleticism in college and at the combine.
The Counter, diving deeper into the NFL with advanced stats, film study, and expert guests. This is The Counter.
Listen and subscribe to The Counter on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
There he is, Nolan King. What's going on, Nolan?
How you doing, guys?
Good. You got punted there for a second, huh? Was that you or is that StreamYard? We're having problems with StreamYard. We're getting ready to brawl. Maybe that's StreamYard messing with us, Goes. Maybe they're behind the scenes. They didn't like what I said. They haven't liked the conversations all weekend, and they're punking us right now.
Yeah. You know, Nolan, for those of you guys who follow the website, he's the one – he's been at all the Bellators. I mean, that's basically his thing with them having their bubble over there. So he's got to make that trip almost once a week down to what is it, Uncasville? Is that what that is?
Mohegan Sun in Uncasville, Connecticut, yeah.
And he's got to cover the Bellator cards. And then on top of that, he's got his UFC duty. So if you want to talk Bellator, there's no better guy than Nolan King.
Yeah. Matt Erickson was doing that for a while, right?
Yeah.
Is it because Nolan's the proximity? It's closer for him to drive, probably the pandemic. But I remember Matt Erickson had Bellator on lockdown a little bit.
Yeah. No, I think it's probably closer. I can't remember how far he said the drive is. I want to say, I remember thinking it's shorter than like Vegas to California. So I think
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's about like 2 hours or something like that, that he's got to drive and get there. And then he's got to stay in there. What do they call it? The fight sphere?
Fight sphere, yeah.
Yeah, so he's got to do all that.
Well, not to worry, Matt Erickson, if you're listening, we'll save you for the Thackerville, Oklahoma cards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no one here. What's going on?
Okay. All right. While we do that, we do have a little bit of other news because I want to save. I know Nolan will pop in a second unless he just got kidnapped. But we did have some new, well, I guess you can call it news. I mean, it's stuff pertaining to the fight card, but Kevin Holland, who defeated Khamzat Chimaev, defeated Ronaldo Souza, called out Khamzat Chimaev. I thought that was a gangster move because even though he's not going to do it, it went along with the theme of, hey, I'd love to get a sixth fight this year. And how about the fact that everyone's running from Chimaev and here I am calling him? It just added to it. Now, we probably all knew that fight wasn't going to happen, but I thought that was very wise of him to even connect those dots.
Yeah, no, I kind of like the matchup, to be honest. I think it's fun, but it's something you have to do in his position. You have to get your name out there. And I was dying, man. I can't remember who said it, but somebody was saying, if he gets that win, man, we'll never hear the end of it. But I like this kid.
Cormier, I think, said that, right?
Yeah, I think Cormier said it.
Cormier said if he subs Jacare Souza, we'll never hear the end of it because subbing Jacare would be a huge feather in his cap. But he'd have every right to talk. Mm-hmm. All right, here's Nolan King again. What's up, Nolan? How you doing?
That's so weird. I don't know. He was saying he was having problems hearing you.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah, maybe it is an issue. We'll have to figure this out, man. I don't know what the hell's going on. But
it went smoother when we didn't have Jamal Hill.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was one thing that I wanted to tip my hat to. That's how you do it, fighters. There is an art to the call out, and honestly, there can be a little bit of an art to a call out that may not even happen. Let's not forget Khamzat Chimaev is fighting, I think, on January 20th against Leon Edwards. They were going to fight this Saturday coming up. However, the Rona got Leon Edwards, so they're going to do it early part of next year. But Chimaev was busy. Chimaev kept claiming that people were declining fights against him. So Kevin Holland got in the mix. You know, Kevin Holland actually is – I think he's actually broken a record, man, for this. I mean, aside from guys that participated in tournaments, he had 5 fights in 206 or 210 days. That's simply amazing, especially at this level. And to go 5-0, I mean, not 4-1, not 3-2, he went 5-0. So look for a little bump, by the way, if I want to give you guys a look behind the curtain to this week's rankings. Kevin Holland's making a move. All right, let's see if the third time is the charm. What's up, Nolan King?
We're here. Yeah.
Welcome, Nolan. We've been dying to unpack UFC 256 with you, we figured. That way we can throw some, you know, thoughts and opinions and takes all the way around, but
sure.
Figueiredo versus Brandon Moreno, it was a great fight, no way around it. It wound up being a draw. Now, one of the judges, Camijo, had he turned in the scorecard that most of us had, which was 10-9 Figueiredo in round three, really, Figueiredo would have won the fight free and clear, even of the one-point deduction. So I want everybody to know that because two judges would have had a winning scorecard for Davis and Figueiredo. Look, I thought that the winner of round five was going to walk away with the belt, but in looking at what the judges had already put together, that wasn't going to be the case. But I thought it was pretty clear Figueiredo had won round five. But anyway, I wanted to clear that up. I know sometimes people don't click on those scorecards. You should, and that way you can kind of have a little bit more intel when going into these discussions. But Nolan, what did you think of the result of Figueiredo, you know, or the fight, the result, all that?
I mean, obviously, I think in line with everyone else, it was a phenomenal fight. One of the best, if not the best, we've ever seen in that division. And I think it really solidified the flyweights sticking around. They're not going anywhere. Division's on the rebuild. Ton of exciting contenders. And I actually think the rematch will be good. I think it will allow for other fighters in that weight class to kind of build themselves a little bit. You know, whether or not Cody Garbrandt wants to to compete, you know, once before he gets the title shot. You got Manel Cape, who weighed in as a backup. You know, that's kind of beside the point, but I think it was good for the division. I think it was an awesome showing. As far as the scoring goes that you brought up, I think that's kind of a something that we don't focus on enough, right? Because we look at the scorecards, and I thought you could have gone with the draw. You could have gone with Figueiredo having one more point than Moreno. I think those were both acceptable scores. So when you see it, you're kind of like, that happens. Like, fair, fine, whatever. But then when you go back and look at the breakdown, you're like, man, that is a scorecard that should not have happened, you know? So I think that's something maybe we need to read between the lines more, where, you know, that judge, if we didn't look deeper into it, that judge would be given a pass, essentially. Like, okay, that's fair. You know, you could have scored it. But then when you see the round breakdown and you see the rounds that he gave, that he gave to each fighter, then you start to question. So I think that that's a good point that you brought up. I can't really be mad at the decision, especially with the great fight. But yeah, I think that again, we're getting into this judging issue over and over again. And even though that's an acceptable scorecard, probably should be something that's revisited.
Can I ask you guys a question here? As people who cover the sport, as fans, to see the rematch, it's pretty exciting. I think we're all happy about that. But if we were Brandon Moreno's coach or his manager, would we be looking to maybe take some time off or get another fight? Because look, if he loses a second fight, now he's in that hole where he's lost twice to the champion and there's not much you can do. So at the same time, I've heard coaches also say behind the scenes, hey, another fight for Figueiredo is more mileage on his body. It's taxing, you know, another camp on his body. What would you guys advise Brandon Moreno if you were his coach or his manager? Would you want the fight, strike while the iron's hot and get the rematch now, or maybe wait a little bit and climb yourself back up? I guess we could start with you, Nolan, since you're the guest.
Yeah, I mean, I think the time is now. You know, I think it's never going to be hotter than it is now. You know, I think people are still buzzing from what just happened. I think both fighters should take time off. I mean, they both fought twice in however many days, less than a month. So for me, I think take some time off, let people focus on other fights. Then, you know, once they're back healthy or whatever you want to call it, ready to fight again, you can start the build. But I think Moreno, you know, if he were to defer any sort of title shot, it could be a mistake, because I think the matchups that await him are very high risk, kind of low reward matchups at the top of that division, because you got two guys that I named earlier, Garbrandt and Cape, who have not fought in this division in the UFC. So it's really hard to gauge how good they are. You know, they could, either one of them could be the best flyweight challenge out there. So it's not necessarily, rankings wise, he's fighting backwards, but it's not necessarily skills wise that could play out to be the case. So for me, if I'm Moreno, I ride this, wait till I get healthy, wait till it's right, go. You know, it will definitely be, I think, more of a draw, obviously, than the first time around. And just ride this wave of success.
Yeah, I thought I was going to have an opposing take to Nolan, but he clarified. So he's saying go next for sure. Don't take another fight. But at the same time, we're not in any hurry, because he had two fights in three weeks. And one of them obviously really, really tested, not just him, but the champion. So I think the UFC should look at both of their assets and go, okay, they need rest. You know, first of all, Figueiredo went to the hospital. I don't know if Moreno wound up going or not, but you could see that he probably did have a break in his forearm. His face showed a lot of damage. Let's not forget, everybody always says two fights, 3 weeks. Oh my God. Hey, how about those camps too? Now the second camp wasn't very long, but you had two camps, two weight cuts in a pandemic. I mean, that's a lot of stress that we're all carrying, you know, and you could just tell Moreno, what he needs is a month. If I was his manager, I'd take his phone and send him somewhere for a month with his wife and his three kids during Christmas. You're going to have a island Christmas this year or something like that. And say, I don't even want to talk to you until January, you know. Let him heal. Let him rest. Let him think about anything except the training camp and Figueiredo or anything else. That will be there, all right? Now, if Figueiredo stays active, and they do give him Cody Garbrandt or someone else, well, I suppose if they're checking in with Moreno anytime before like April, I might say I'll just get the winner of Garbrandt and Figueiredo. But you know how the UFC can be as well. When you turn them down, sometimes you just get put, you know, somewhere else. But see, the fans are going to demand it this time. I think the fans are going to demand it. They're not going to let Moreno just fall out, because Moreno, he punched the clock. He had a great performance. So I'd like to see Moreno fight sometime in July. Same goes for Figueroa. Who knows what's going to wind up happening. It's exciting to see Cody drop to 125. It's exciting to see Cejudo tweet that he might be back. But at some point, we do need to see Brandon Moreno versus Davison Figueiredo again. That was an awesome tilt. In fact, little segue there. What did you guys think when you heard Dana White say that, where it was relayed to somebody, that Dana White said that was the best title fight he's ever seen at flyweight? Immediately, I think another one that comes to mind is Cejudo versus DJ.
I think when you look at that fight, though, I think Cejudo DJ, you could say, was the most tactical fight at flyweight. This one was, I don't want to say rock 'em sock 'em, but it was just, it had a little bit more drama in it. It was just a fun fight, versus the other one being, I think, the most tactical fight we've seen in flyweight division.
Yeah, I agree with Goz right there. You know, it's the Mighty Mouse versus Cejudo, the second fight, was very one of those championship fights you watch and you're like just so impressed that these guys are that good. You know what I mean? Wow, they, like, the stuff they showed is unbelievable. I think it takes a certain acquired taste to kind of watch that fight and really appreciate it. But the Figueiredo-Moreno fight, I think you could just pull somebody off the street and have them watch it and be like, man, this is like wild shit. So that's I think Goz is on the money with that remark there.
Nobody's wrong, honestly. Yeah. Anybody whose opinion is that DJ Cejudo's one, Figueiredo Moreno's two, or vice versa. I mean, it's all how you interpret it. They all had fun tactical moments. But honestly, that's one of the, I think MMA is one of those where you do file a fight, but you don't remember the details. And you have to go back and watch it again to really, really make that assessment and have, you know, that sort of a discussion. If you're really going to get into it, you know what I mean? But you just have that feeling. I remember that special feeling where round five did feel like, wow, the winner of this could be the champ. And DJ hadn't lost in a decade. You know, I mean, that was literally, you know, the David and Goliath type of moment. Nobody hates DJ, but you sometimes just kind of root for some sort of a change. And nobody knew that this was going to make DJ go away. We didn't want that either. I'd love to see him go a third time. But I just remember going, wow, this could be pretty historic, pretty special. And it wound up being that way. This fight was different. This is just two more modern, younger fighters that happen to collide, you know, sooner in their lives, which with less of a buildup. But it didn't take away from being pretty damn exciting.
Yeah. I got two questions for you guys revolving around this fight. The first question is this. Seeing Davidson Figueiredo's performance that night, would Henry Cejudo have beaten him if they had fought? That's the first question. And then the second, remember when a fighter says, hey, I'm retiring, I'm going away, at the age that Henry Cejudo did it, with the success that he was having, a lot of times when they do that, they like to let things play out and they hope that it almost looks miserable enough where you say, man, we need this guy back. Let's give him whatever the hell he needs. That performance from those two guys, did that help Cejudo in the sense that the UFC saying, we got to get him back, man, that Davidson Figueiredo is a beast. We got to give him someone to fight? Or were they kind of like, I don't know, we had pretty good success without this guy. Let's let him sweat longer. So two questions. We'll start with George this time since we started with Nolan last time.
Okay. I think when Cejudo left the sport, he looked pretty close to unbeatable. I think Moreno got those takedowns against Figueiredo that I didn't expect that many of them, you know? He just wasn't able to capitalize, especially with that back take that he's really, really good at, because Figueiredo's so athletic, so fast. So I think Cejudo could have gotten him down, and Cejudo needed those takedowns against DJ. So I think he could have gotten him down. Could he have done something with him? Perhaps. I don't know. But he's looking to ground and pound, not necessarily try and get to the dominant positions to look for a sub. But Cejudo, man, like, I thought he was hitting harder as a bantamweight than he was as a flyweight. When he was kicking Dominic's legs, when he was punching you know, and throwing hands at Marias. I mean, wow, that guy was something else. So I think Cejudo, to answer the question about would Cejudo have beaten Figueiredo, yes. And then what was the other one, guys? Can you say it real quick?
And then do you think this helped Henry Cejudo's cause? Or
yes, because there's a level of excitement to the flyweight division or even the bantamweight division. I think so. I'm anxious to know, why isn't Dana pursuing Henry to come back the way he's pursuing Khabib to come back? I get it. Khabib's way more of a pay-per-view draw because he's linked to the possible fight versus Conor McGregor. Maybe if that fight didn't exist, maybe Dana White wouldn't pull for it as much. Maybe Russia's more valuable than Mexico when it comes to doing business for the UFC, which I would highly doubt. One of them could be ahead of the other one, but not by much because they both have rich combat sports history. So I don't know, but I wish he would actually kind of like just nudge in the media, Cejudo, you know, to come back, because that guy can be a star at flyweight or bantamweight, but I'd love to see him return to flyweight.
But you know, Alan?
Yeah, as far as the winner goes, I think whoever said this was right. When Henry Cejudo stepped away, he looked unbeatable. It didn't look like there were many challenges there. So for him to leave and have this division have not only guys that earned shots, you know, kind of at the top of this division, but new guys that are new faces, people coming in out of left field, working their way up through the rankings. So it's kind of a trip to try to compare, you know, Cejudo then to the division now. And we've seen Figueiredo's dominance, but that's kind of the intrigue, right? That's the exact thought process that's built Cejudo's case. If he were to come back, to make him and Figueiredo or Moreno a big fight, you know, there's a challenge. There's somebody there that cleaned out a few contenders to get their shot, to win the belt, to be exciting. And to me, that's what Cejudo needed in order to elevate himself to even a bigger draw. So, you know, I think that I kind of answered your second question first, but Cejudo versus Figueiredo, I mean, I think I would still lean with Henry just because I think he has a few more weapons. I think he just seemed to never really peak. He seemed to be getting better and better and better, and then he left. So I would lean towards Cejudo, but I'm really interested in that fight. I think that would have more intrigue in a flyweight title fight than maybe any flyweight title fight that we've seen before. So, you know, maybe Cejudo, Dillashaw, you could have that conversation too, but I'm all in for it. Like you said, I don't know why Dana's not pursuing. I think that it is interesting. Maybe that's a question that needs to be asked or kind of more often.
Yeah, because when DC was threatening, you know, age 40, March 19th, I think of 2018, Dana White would go, oh, I don't think he wants to leave. No, look how he's performed, blah, blah, blah. Any other fighter who says the R word, he's like, you know, when you hear the R word, you don't want that guy coming back. He may get hurt, or he or she. But with DC, you know, like he just kept pushing it and pushing it. With Khabib, oh, I don't believe him. His dad won in 30-0. I mean, come on. There's something there, obviously. But with Cejudo, they've had somebody golden there for so many years. It took him having to be cringy for him to get more popular. But the fact that he was a gold medalist for the United States in wrestling, oof, I just thought that more should have came with that a little bit quicker. He speaks Spanish very well. Now he speaks Portuguese. But I think when he left, man, he was on the cusp of being even bigger and, you know, and just taking huge, huge steps. But who knows what soured him? Maybe he asked for another zero on the check. Perhaps. Maybe he wakes up with headaches and we just don't know about it, you know, and that's a concern to him. Who knows? I don't know, man. But I just wish the UFC would kind of do that whole, you know, we want to check in with Cejudo and make sure, you know, because we'd love to have him back. He still has more to give to the sport. We haven't heard that. So, and that's the stuff that behind the scenes, sometimes when you hear about it years later, you're like, oh, I get it. But we don't know it at the time.
Yeah. And Cejudo's, you know, retirement out of the names you just listed, I thought was the most premature. Like Khabib's obviously in his prime, but he's done so much. With Cejudo, it was like he hadn't even, you know, gotten to the point where we thought he was close to saying the R word. So when Dana White was at that press conference after UFC 249 and he kind of shrugged it off like, yeah, I think he's retired, like all that stuff. It kind of sparked a red flag with me. You know, it's just, to me, it seemed like a negotiating tactic on Cejudo's side and, you know, a negotiating response on Dana's side. And they both were probably aware of the figures that or whatever. I know I'm kind of speculating here, but it just was so unusual. We see, like you said, DC's older. He's kind of, I don't want to say over the hill, but maybe he's not at his prime. and Dana's practically dragging him back in and saying, telling everyone. Habib, you know, gave a pretty heartfelt explanation as to why he's done. Oh, no, he's not done either. And then you got Cejudo, who's, you know, considered a young champion that hasn't even really really peaked yet. He retires so out of left field. And Dana's like, yep, that's it. So something's up one way or another. But, yeah, I would love to see Henry Cejudo back, you know.
Me too. Me too, man. I don't want to disrupt anything that has to do with Yan versus Sterling. I think Sterling deserves this title shot. But I think right now he could maybe cut the line a little bit more at flyweight if he wanted to, especially while Marino, I think, gets healthy. And like Goz says, you don't want to be 0-2 against the incumbent. You know, all of a sudden it just becomes a little bit more difficult to get that third shot. You saw Joseph Benavidez needed like 5-7 years just to even get a whiff. And it had to be a different guy, honestly. But this was his third and fourth attempt this year to win the flyweight title. But yeah, you know, random fact here, DC and Cejudo were on the same Olympic team in 2008 in Beijing, China. DC was like a 30-year-old, Cejudo as a 20-year-old. Cejudo straight out of high school, man. He said, nope, no college, going straight to the Olympic Training Center. Prepped himself, got himself a gold medal. But yeah, they're like 10 years apart. But as far as, you know, being colleagues, I guess, or teammates, they were in 2008. Anyway, you know, that's done. And I want to move on to El Cucuy versus Charles Oliveira. Charles Oliveira got the win there. Dominant, I think it was 30-26 across the board for him. Man, usually I want to start off with the winner. We're going to give him all his praise and then we'll talk about what's next. But I want to start with El Cucuy, guys. What's going on here? Is he just aging in front of our eyes, or are we just not giving enough credit to Gaethje and Oliveira back to back?
Probably not giving enough credit to those two guys. I mean, they're tough outs, and they really are. And Oliveira, in Gaethje, I think a lot of people saw it was going to be a tough fight. With Oliveira, I think people were surprised, but he just has that type of game that is very hard to prepare for. Until you're actually in there with him, you don't realize just how smart and how he's always a couple steps ahead.
Yeah, I agree with Goz, and it's kind of unfortunate. You know, I there's so many what-ifs in MMA, and to look back on Tony's career and the time where he was at his highest value, for him not to have fought like ever really is just, it's too bad, you know. And the Habib fight, I think, will go down as, when we talk about matchups in the future that get canceled, like, that will be what we always compare to, like, oh, this is getting to Tony Habib status, you know. It's been canceled twice. Like, I think it's going to be something that lives on in MMA forever, as unfortunate as it is. And you know, Charles Oliveira, I think, didn't get his credit, but I also think that Tony, his last two fights, you know, have kind of showed me that perhaps he's not necessarily where he was during the time that he wasn't competing, you know, or the infrequent fights that we saw from him. It just seems to be a little off, and maybe it is just trying to, you know, now he's getting more consistent with fighting, and maybe we're seeing him more. Maybe these guys are just evolving past him. Maybe, you know, Justin and Charles are just able to improve more and more and more past him. But yeah, it's tough. I don't know where his path to the title would be from here or anything like that. He's getting up there in age. I think he's a guy that people will always love and always want to see fight. But you also got a question, you know, the where do you go from here? What's the path? And I really, at this point in time, we've seen crazier things, but there's nothing that I out there that indicates to me that, you know, he's going to have easier fights going forward. That's going to get him to a title fight. You know, there just seems like this was a big step back for him.
Yeah. You know, he never got going. He never got anything going. And what I want to know is, this could be a long topic here. I'm going to try and shorten it as much as I can. Rashad Evans once told us years ago that the more you learn, let's say you're a specialist and you have 500 techniques or strategies or thoughts of what you want to do when you're in the cage, and you get better and learn more and more and more, and you get to 1,000, all of a sudden your mind gets so flooded that you forget your actual bread and butter plays, I guess, if you will, and you don't execute them. And next thing you know, you're getting punched in the face. You're taking damage. You start talking to yourself. You start overthinking. And I'm wondering if that happened with Tony Ferguson. Tony Ferguson, you know, was a wrestler in college, and then he knocked out Nijum in the Ultimate Fighter finale. So, you know, he said, I got some power. Don't doubt my power. And then, of course, he was the king of the front chokes, the Darces. You know, he had great jujitsu. cardio for days. I mean, he seemed to tick every box. But yet in the last couple fights, I'm not seeing. I don't know. I don't know if he fell in love with the fact that he's so good at everything. He's just going to blend and eventually catch you with something and draw you into deep water, you know, deep waters and outswim you. I don't know. That, in fact, nothing's really getting going. Like, I'd love to see him go for an actual takedown and see if he can rain some elbows on you that way. Or establish a jab, you know, or start kicking your calf. But do something and kind of commit to it. And then once the other guy starts taking damage, then start picking them apart a little bit. I feel like that's what Oliveira did to him. And so he never really got going. Now, it doesn't mean he sucks, obviously. He was off a 12-fight win streak before he lost these back-to-back fights. Well, what I did do was I looked back. Who were his three previous wins? He got Cerrone, Pettis, and Lee. Let's break them down just really quick. So Cerrone and Pettis, one could argue, are probably just past their prime years. So they're credible wins because you're still in there against the crafty veteran. They were good fights, but, you know, maybe were they too overvalued? I don't know. And then Kevin Lee was kind of the young guy who I think is still not peaked. I still think he was just a raging hot, you know, a young gun, you know, who's still going to round out his game eventually. But maybe he got him too early, you know. And then, of course, we get to RDA, which was an outstanding win. That was the one that took place in Mexico City, 9,000 feet altitude. But, you know, I'm just wondering here, man, what could it have been? I couldn't believe that I was actually looking back and questioning Tony Ferguson and his 12 wins and how we got here. But sometimes you just have to do that and then think, you know, like what could have possibly gone so wrong in these last two fights?
Yeah, I mean, to me, like, you broke it down there, and I think it's difficult because you don't want to. There's always going to be a recency bias. Like, you know, we look at Donald Cerrone and we say, okay, we know he's lost a bunch of fights. Or we look at Anthony Pettis and we say, okay, we know he lost a bunch of fights. But it's always hard to measure what the fighter at the time, because every single fighter we see gets eventually beat up, it seems like. There's very few guys that go through this thing and don't have downs and don't have a lot of downs before they retire or they leave the company or whatever. So it is difficult, but I also understand what you're saying. You kind of got to put it in context, right? You know, so it's challenging. And I think Tony Ferguson's a perfect example of that, where it's like, you know, even some of the fights that he had when he won, it seemed like he took a pretty solid beating at times. And it's like an imperfect science. I don't think we'll ever have a right answer for it. I think there's going to be a lot of questions that are always left open about how good certain people were at certain times. And we've seen the opposite side of that too, where there'll be fighters that, you know, they had three fights in the UFC, they went 0-3, and then you went back and looked at who they fought, and it's all guys that end up to go on to be title challengers or something. So it is really difficult, and we can make our guesses and assumptions. And in Tony's case, you know, I like to think still that he was at the top of his game for those years. But if you, like you said, I mean, Pettis, Cerrone, Kevin Lee, all three of those guys have seemed to, you know, I'm kind of not speaking factually right now, but they seem to have lost more than they've won since they fought Tony. So it's something to bring up, and it's something to take in consideration when we look forward and try to predict the future.
I think when you look at those wins that he had, we always talk about, you know, college football. If you're the University of Alabama and you get Alcorn State, you can't just win the fight. You got to win by like 40. And if you look at those fights, not saying that they're Alcorn State, Anthony Pettis or Donald Cerrone or Kevin Lee, but he got finishes in those fights. So if you're going to go back and question at all the level of the competition, the fact that he got finishes over all three of them, I think says a lot about Tony Ferguson. I think he just ran into a freight train in Justin Gaethje, and just a difficult puzzle to solve in Charles Oliveira, a guy whose game is evolving in front of our eyes. I think he's maturing right in front of us right now.
And I think Charles doesn't get the credit he deserves in all this. That's kind of the silver lining. I mean, we always talk about, you know, I'm sure you guys have had this conversation numerous times with fighters, but, you know, the long term, I'm not in this for just this fight. I want to, you know, I have my long-term journey. It's all about improvement. It's all about learning. You learn from losses more than wins, blah, blah, blah. And for him, I mean, he's going to be like one of the longest long-term projects ever. Like, you know, he's up there in UFC, in a few of the records. And he's just getting better, man. He's finally put it all together. He's got a boatload of experience behind him. And he's an elite fighter. It took him years and whatever, 10 years in the UFC to get to this point. And here he is. And I think we still haven't seen potentially the best Charles Oliveira that we're going to.
Mm-hmm. And he hasn't burned out. We talked about Rory McDonald starting at the age of 16 and kind of burning out around 26, 28. Oliveira doesn't seem to have burned out. Now, he took his fair share of losses. And I thought Tony Ferguson could break him, eventually just take it to him and break him. That's something that Charles Oliveira has to come to, and that's fighting the elite fighters. But in this fight, he was patient and he took it slow, but he kind of just beat Ferguson everywhere, including the takedowns, you know. And credit to Oliveira for evolving his game. I think Ferguson's still going to be a tough out going forward for people. But what I did see in Ferguson is something I saw earlier in the fight card with JDS. It's something I've seen with Tyron Woodley, and that's just that hesitancy, man. That split second where you've cornered your guy where you want him, using your experience, your footwork, your ringmanship, whatever you want to call it, but then they fire back at you before you fire at them, you know. And if it's a costly strike, you know, that causes damage or whatever, that together with what's happening mentally, you know, that they're thinking about what they want to do. Man, I'm telling you, for the aging fighter, it's like a poison. I was telling Goes, when JDS was fighting Cyril, I could see him thinking, you know, but those hands just weren't going. And then Cyril slowly was, you know, throwing something sloppy, or then maybe an uppercut, and then they start to land. And, of course, we can talk about the possible illegal strike or whatever, but JDS would throw eventually, but just not often like he did when he was younger. And you're more experienced, but if you're just not pulling that trigger, man, with those 4-ounce gloves, I don't know what to tell you. Tyron Woodley in the Gilbert Burns fight, I know he got smoked in that fight, but when he was in it early on, the one thing he was doing that he wasn't doing in some of his previous fights is he was starting early and he was throwing. It's just Gilbert Burns managed to dodge a little bit of it, return fire, things like that. But I remember the second time Miocic fought JDS, Miocic says, "One more calf kick and I would have been in a lot of trouble." And I was wondering, why didn't JDS attack Cyril's legs? You know, if he's not going to throw some hands, attack his legs. I mean, do something that causes him to react to you, because when it's the other way around, it's just, I don't know, it's one car, it's a car collision, except one guy's going, you know, downward, the other one's going upward. Who do you think will take the worst impact? Is Oliveira next, guys? Did he leapfrog RDA? It's kind of, what have you done for me lately, a little bit. He's got the win streak. RDA only got just back to lightweight in his last fight, the win over Felder. But if we're to believe Habib's retired and Poirier and Connor are next for the title, is Oliveira next? No, we'll start with Nolan.
It's tough to say. You know, it sounds like there's a little from kind of what we're hearing, myself and some of the other people from MMA Junkie, it seems like there is kind of an open field at the top of the 155-pound division in terms of the UFC's, you know, who's next in line, so to speak. And I know Dana said he's going to meet with Habib next month, and we'll see how that goes. You know, taking him, assuming that he's out of the picture, which is maybe an unfair assumption, you know, you have Connor and Dustin, which seems like the winner of that will probably put themselves in a title, you know, shot of some sort. And then you've also got Michael Chandler still. I think we're going to see him fight sooner rather than later. You've got Justin Gaethje. You know, he was the number one contender. The only guy he lost to in that streak was Habib. So he's going to be in the conversation. And then I think after, you know, in that same field of fighters, you have Charles Oliveira and you know, you still got Dan Hooker. You still got other guys that you can use as pieces and see who they can, you know, if one of those other fighters I named needs a matchup, they can kind of be, you know, a fight or two away from some sort of opportunity. To answer your, you know, specifically about Charles, I think he's in that conversation. I don't think, given the star stature of the other names that I laid out, he would necessarily leapfrog one of them. I think probably, like I said, Poirier, McGregor winner, and then either Chandler, Gaethje, you know, then Charles, I would say, would kind of be the pecking order.
Yeah, I agree with Nolan. I think he did make a significant jump, and depending on the scenario, I think he could be a little higher than we think. But I will say this, man, I know it's unpopular, but if if Conor McGregor, if that fight is for a title and he wins that title, Charles Oliveira ain't seeing that fight for a while. That is the last dude they're going to want to match up Conor McGregor with. So it really just depends on what's going on up at the top. Can I segue real quick and ask you guys a question about this card overall? Sure. George, you brought up JDS a little while ago, and then there's Jacare Souza, this kind of older guard. Dana White had talked about some of these names are going to start to go away. You know, he's, I think, give the number 60, around 60 guys are going to be gone. Nolan, you've been over at Bellator. You've had Scott Coker's ear, and he's kind of addressed some of the free agents and why he went after some and why he hasn't gone after others. I think a lot of us for the longest time felt like when these guys are ready to go, Bellator is a popular destination for some of them, right? You're loyal to Machidas of the world, these types of signings. But now Scott is kind of hinting that they like their homegrown talent and perhaps they're not going to go that route. What do you think is going to happen with free agency now for this type of fighter? I'm a little bit older in age and a little bit more wear and tear. Where are they going to end up, guys?
You know, that's a good question. I think Bellator is really, 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 it's not just the way things have played out. That's what they want to do from now on. They really want to, you know, not be known as the promotion that signs the UFC's fighters that they cut. And I don't know, you know, when you guys went on the air, they signed Yoel Romero today. So they actually went back on, you know, Scott Coker told me that they had passed, and it seems like that was true. And then maybe I think Yoel moving up a weight class to 205 pounds is something that twisted his arm. He saw him as a good addition. So it just seemed to me, though, that the reason that they passed on him was less about Yoel and more about the optics of the whole thing. I think that their mission statement has been to move away from being, you know, getting guys based only on their name recognition and name recognition alone. So, you know, again, they did go back on that decision, but I think it will be very unusual for you to see somebody get cut from the UFC or released and not, and then have them sign with Bellator. You know, I just think there'll be very few circumstances where that happens now. And that was, I mean, that's the big joke, right? That's the big, the thing. You see the comments on Twitter, people are always, you know, they'll say the UFC cut someone and somebody have a meme of Scott Coker like peeking out, and you know, it's that's been unfortunately or fortunately their MO. And I think they're really, really, really trying to move away from that. It makes sense financially to not be paying Roy Nelson a ton of money and to sign, you know, give some up and comers good contracts. These guys are getting paid, LFA champs are getting paid more for their first fight in Bellator than they are in the UFC by almost double from what I'm hearing. So they're definitely trying to make it a place where prospect development is something they focus on. And it's going to take some time. It's going to, some name recognition, as much as people can make fun of it, does go a long way when it comes to viewership. You know, you can throw Ken Shamrock and Hoist Gracie in there and have them have everybody's eyeballs on it. People that hate it, people that love it, people that don't understand, you know, or you can have Magomed Magomedov, who nobody knows necessarily in the United States, who's an excellent, excellent fighter, but it's going to take some time for him to get the name recognition. And I think that that's the case for the entire roster. So it's definitely an interesting situation here. You all signing this morning, maybe threw a little monkey wrench in the consistency of Bellator staying away from these guys, but I'm excited. I'm excited to see the competition and where Bellator, you know, how they pick and choose who they take.
Yeah, together with Anthony Johnson, Phil Davis, Ryan Bader, Nemkov, their champ.
Corey Anderson.
And now Yoel Romero. And Musasi saying he'll probably finish at 205. That's a formidable 205 division. That's the one Coker's been arguing that his is better than the UFC's now that John Jones has left the UFC's 205 division. And he's going to compete as a heavyweight. So we'll see. I would have preferred Romero, honestly, at PFL because I think that gives them a chance to compete. And there's that big prize at the end. And look, if he wins, good for him. He should get those paydays on his way out. And if not, then guess what? So whoever beat him along the way, that person becomes a big name. You know, not that I mind him over at Bellator, but I'm kind of liking what Scott's saying. We're just gonna occasionally groom or occasionally sign a free agent when we can, but let's just groom our own cats like the Pitbull brothers and Chandler and AJ McKee and some of the others. You know, I kind of like that strategy. All right, look, we're coming up on the end of the show, but I do want to go to Nolan for one last thing. You were there for Juliana Velasquez versus Yelima Leigh McFarlane, two undefeated fighters fighting for a world title. That's kind of rare, actually. But Velasquez was just, it looked like too big, too strong for Yelima Leigh. Yelima Leigh made quite a run there at the end. What did you think of the fight overall? And what do you think Bellator has in Velasquez?
I mean, the first word that comes to mind is exactly what Juliana Velasquez told me before the fight she thought would be the big difference in the fight, and that's athleticism. I mean, just seeing her in person and talking to her, she's an athlete. You know, you look at her, she's very muscular. She's very fit in terms of maybe even more unusual than we see with a lot of the female fighters. I mean, she kind of almost build-wise reminds me a little bit of Valentina Shevchenko. Like, you know, she's not necessarily like somebody like Amanda Nunes, very imposing, right? You see her, she's just beast mode on people. And Valentina still has that savageness and that savagery and that look. And I think Juliana is very similar in that regard. Clearly a very strong person, a very talented person. And again, another fighter whose limit has not been touched. I mean, Yelima Leigh had her moments. I thought her post-fight interview was phenomenal. I thought her attitude was great, really great champion. But she was, you know, it was pretty clear who the better fighter was when those two stepped in there. So for me, I don't really know who in Bellator could beat her, you know, and I think that might be a good thing for Bellator. I think the fact that they could have a champion that, again, builds some, you know, not mystique, but builds up their reputation as somebody that's unbeatable. I think that will be helpful for them going forward. And she's a very legitimate athlete, very legitimate background. And I was supremely impressed with her performance in there, you know, and her attitude. I think she's somebody that, you know, she doesn't speak English yet. And maybe she's something she can work on, try to connect with the crowd more. But, you know, her answers to my questions, if Ed Suarez was telling me the truth and he wasn't making up what she was saying, she was really good on the mic. So I'm excited to see where she goes from here. And I think Bellator is a scary, scary 125-pound champion.
Yeah, and that's their, I think, fourth Brazilian champion across five weight classes, because Pitbull doubles up as lightweight and featherweight. So good for her. Congrats to her. That's a great champion to win your belt. That always seems so much when you can beat the incumbent and they're a big name. Just that process of, you know, can you imagine if Whitaker had actually taken it from Anderson Silva? Or Chris Weidman, even maybe, I don't know, versus when you just come in through and they just belt you like they did Aldo, or there's a vacancy or something like that, it's a little bit different, you know. But when you can take it off somebody like Cejudo off Johnson and now Velasquez off Yelima Leigh, I mean, that carries so much more weight than, you know, the other ways that I've seen it done. But anyway, all right, hey, thanks for joining us, Nolan, today. I know you got a busy day. Great job out there, as always. In the fight sphere. Stay safe, and I guess we'll be talking to you soon.
Appreciate it, guys. Anytime you need me, I'll be here, and yeah, we'll be talking.
Thank you.
Gracias, Nolan.
De nada.
All right, folks. One other thing here, we're going to bounce pretty quick too, but let's just at least give you the results. Mackenzie Dern did defeat Virna Jandiroba. That was a women's strawweight bout. Dern looked great. She's now 10-1. Overall, I believe 5-1 in the UFC. She gets these finishes. Didn't this on this fight, but she speaks English, has some power in her hands. I think she's got really, really good potential, and she's slowly just getting better and better as she creeps up towards the top. Kevin Holland, can't say enough about him. He might be up for Fighter of the Year. I got to imagine Jan Blachowicz, you know, he's probably going to get some consideration. And, of course, Davison Figueiredo's had a busy year as well. He's going to get some consideration. But 5-0 in 206 days, that's amazing. He took out Jacare Souza. And how about the fact, goes, that he was on his back and then just kind of swatted at him and then slowly got up as he swatted harder and harder. And next thing you know, they traded spots. Jacare's out while Kevin Holland's wailing on him. That was an unusual way to stop a fighter.
Yeah, for sure. That was a great performance, man. You're right. How do you not argue for a guy like that to be Fighter of the Year? And it's so funny that, I mean, you just go back to who he was last year, and now look at him, what he's accomplished.
Yeah, and look, it's probably going to be a two-horse race, but if you break it down like this, if I'm supporting Holland, I would say about Figueiredo, Well, you did go 3-1. You missed weight once, and you drew. Sorry, you didn't go 3-1. You went 3-0-1. You drew in your last fight. I won 5 times. You drew once. You won 3 times. One of them, you didn't even make weight. So only 2 of them have become title defenses. But still, Figueiredo would go, I got a belt. You know, I got a belt. You may have 5 wins, but I got a belt. So where does that offset? I don't know. We're not talking about who's the better pound for pound or who's the more popular or rich or famous. Just who was the best, who had the bigger year in 2020. That could be debated many ways. Cub Swanson, we mentioned him. Fiziev, sorry, we got this one. Rafael Fiziev, Gavin Tucker, Tisha Torres, Chase Hooper. I think I said that already, actually. The bonuses went to Figueiredo Moreno. No shocker there. For fight of the night, Kevin Holland and Rafael Fiziev, they got the performances of the night. So I imagine the only ones that could really be upset might be
Swanson.
Who?
Swanson could be upset.
Swanson might be upset. Gane can't be upset. Gane's elbow. I can't believe it didn't get talked about a little bit more. To me, it seemed like the impact of the elbow to the back of the head was clear. Now, somewhere along the line, as he retracted or pulled back, you know, it wasn't a boomerang, right? It's attached to his shoulder. So as it came back, maybe some of that gets the ear on the way back. Who knows? But to me, it looked like clear impact. The problem is JDS would have more of a case if they would have decided that on fight night and just ruled it a no contest. I don't think it would have been warranted as a disqualification, because in that whole process of JDS kind of turning away and running away, you know, I think Herzog would probably give Gane the benefit of the doubt there that he wasn't just gunning for that. But I think JDS will probably appeal. I wouldn't blame him. I just don't think he has much of a chance to clear it unless they have some really, really good angles and footage. Who knows? Who knows? I mean, if it's the rightful thing, they should. But it's kind of like in the NFL. They usually go with what was decided on the field. You got to really, really overwhelmingly impress them with evidence for them to overturn. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. Did you see any subsequent replays, anything that told you different goes?
Nah, just the very last replay that I saw felt like maybe the forearm part right here is what hit the ear. From here on, kind of came over and hit the back, in my opinion. So I thought it should have been legal.
And that wasn't the part that jacked him up, that forearm grazing the air. It was the actual boom, you know, the elbow part getting him. Another thing I wanted to say was, early on we talked about Moreno and Figueiredo, and I said if Comedio gives that last round to Figueiredo, Figueiredo would have won the fight. Yes, what that means is that 2 of the judges would have had it 4-1, Figueiredo. However, what I'm saying is there are other rounds you could argue that Moreno may have won. Like that 9-9, a lot of journalists that I know scored it 10-8 for Moreno. Thereby, they gave the round to Moreno. But see, the 3 judges here gave the fight to Figueiredo. That's why it was only a 9-9. It would have been a 10-9 Figueiredo round if not for the point deduction. And then in round 2, I think they were really, really close on significant strikes. What I can't remember is when Moreno got his takedowns, because he had about 4 or 5 of them, really, really nice ones. So that's why I think everyone felt like this fight was a little bit closer than it would have seemed had they revealed 4-1 scores or 49-46 scores. But I'm just telling you how it plays out here according to the 10-9 system. If that judge gives Figueiredo the fight or the 5th round, which he should have, then Figueiredo would become champ. Goz and I, at our watch-along, said whoever wins round 5 is probably going to win, but that's because we thought that the judges had either given Moreno round 2 or 3, and they didn't. So even if Moreno would have won that round, it still would have been a draw on 2 judges' scorecards. And as you know, a draw is like a loss for the challenger because the champion goes home with the belt. So I wanted to clear that up. And then a couple other notes that I had was oh, no, I guess we covered it all. Yeah, I had, you know, mentioning Triple C, Juliana Velasquez. So that was pretty much it. I mean, we're going to be back on Thursday, obviously, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. We'll talk some more. We're going to do our spinning back click video series here in a couple hours as well. And some of these topics will be, you know, talked about. So check us out over at our YouTube page. It's youtube.com/MMAJunkieVideo. You can see our spinning back click franchise series that we do once a week, along with rankings report, and along with all the videos that the writers and editors and videographers produce throughout the week pertaining to UFC, Bellator, anywhere where we can get our cameras out, we do. So that's it for that. Thank you so much again for Saturday for your support for the UFC 256 watch along. We imagine we'll be back for UFC 257. We'll talk it over with the fellas and sportscaster, but old Conor McGregor is going to be headlining that one. So that one's usually a slam dunk, right, Goes?
You would think, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if he fought Fozzie Bear, I'm pretty sure it's a slam dunk. You know, if he just does shuffleboard against Fozzie Bear on a cruise ship, it's a pay-per-view that just needs to be watched. Conor McGregor's a superstar. We're out of here. Be a champion, stay safe, and sane. We'll see you all on Thursday.